annual Founder Day celebration. My name's Harmon Veely, and I'm a real alcoholic. Here for. I love doing this. This is one of the best benefits of being sober, being able to. This is one of the best benefits of being sober, being able to do something for Founders Day and choosing a speaker. The gentleman I asked this afternoon called on New Year's Eve. I remember the day. Checked his calendar, and miraculously, he was open this weekend. Charlie's a very, very busy man. I met him about 5 years ago, and ever since then, a lot of good things have come my way. Without anything further for me, I'll give you Charlie.
I've been asked to lead us in a serenity prayer, so those of you that wish to, please join with me in the serenity prayer after a few moments of silent meditation. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Thank you. My name is Charlie Parmin. I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic sex maniac. I haven't found it necessary to indulge in either one today. Yet. Barbara, the lovely Al-Anon lady that I'm currently married to, told me on the way up here, she said, Charlie, why don't you talk more about spirituality and less about sex when you go to Akron? And I said, Barbara, I don't know anything that's more spiritual than sex. I spent the first 50 years of my life praying I could do it twice. I spent the last 15 praying I could do it once. So it is a pretty spiritual thing in our household. They say they're having some trouble hearing in the middle somewhere, so whoever has got the controls, if they could, maybe we can get the speakers turned on or whatever we need to do. I'd hate for you to miss any of this talk, you know. It's going to be pretty important, so. I want to start by saying I want to thank the committee for asking me to be here. I want to thank the committee for all the work that they do that's involved in setting something like this up. I've been involved in some of this before, and I know there's a lot of work takes place way before we ever get up here. I want to thank the speakers who have spoken before I have, carrying the message of recovery for both AA and Al-Anon. And I want to thank you all for being here, because if you wasn't here, it would be just a hell of a meeting if it were just Harmon and I, and that's all we had here. So thank you for being here, too. My sponsor told me after I first got sober, he told me that someday if I stayed sober long enough, they would let me speak before an AA group. But I think this is absolutely ridiculous. This is carrying it a little too far. This is a hell of a group. And like Pam this morning, I've got butterflies in my stomach also, and maybe we can get settled down in a little bit and get started with this thing. I've been sitting around this morning thinking about what has taken place in AA since the very beginning of this thing. And who would ever have dreamed on January the 10th, 1935, when Bill gave Dr. Bob the bottle of beer in the parking lot before he went upstairs and did the surgery, You know, Dr. Bob was a proctologist, and I'm glad he wasn't working on my procto that morning. But who would ever have dreamed that we would have here in on June 11th of 1930 or 1994, approximately 18,000 people here who are staying sober because of the thing that they started on June 10th, 1935. Who would have ever dreamed that in the summer of 1937 that 18 people got together here in Akron and made a decision to write the big book Alcoholics Anonymous? Who would ever have dreamed that today there would be 18,000 of us here because of the message contained in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous? Who would ever have dreamed in 1939, when the big book was first published, that we would have over 2 million people worldwide today staying sober through the message in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous? And who would ever have dreamed that we would be in 151 countries worldwide? The actual miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, strictly by the grace of God. And because of that grace of God, we're all here today, and we're all able to be sober, and hopefully we've been able to recover from this thing called alcoholism. And as I start my story, I always like to go back for just a few minutes, talk about how I grew up and the great effect that alcohol had on me from the very beginning. I'm not going to speak very much about a drunkalogue. I think most of you here that are alcoholic know all you need to know about drinking. And those of you that are here that have lived and loved we alcoholics, you probably know about all you need to know about our drinking too. In fact, you probably know more about it than we do. What I mainly want to talk about today is just a little bit about my first drunk. Very little about the in-between, a little bit about my last drunk, but what I really want to talk about is what happened to me after I came to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I think that's what's important to us all. And I heard Pam talking this morning, and so many things she said seems to fit me just exactly. Because she talked about when she grew up, she never fit in anywhere. And as a young boy growing up, I never did fit in anywhere either. I was always a little short kid. Seemed like I've always worn glasses. And I was kind of chubby when I grew up. And I found out that little short fat boys that wear glasses have a hard time fitting in just about anywhere they go. And all the guys that I grew up with, they were into athletics of some type. And I remember I wanted to be a part of that athletic scene also. And one day I went to the football coach and I asked him to let me try out for the football team. Now, I'm not sure this is what he said, but it seems as though he smiled and said to me, "Son, I'm sorry, but little short fat boys that wear glasses don't make very good football players. Why don't you try out for the basketball team?" And I remember going to the basketball coach, and he said to me, "Son, I'm sorry, but little short fat boys that wear glasses don't make very good basketball players. Why don't you try out for the track team?" Always on the outside of the crowd looking in. Always wanted to be a part of and knew that I could not be. And I remember also in those days as a teenager growing up, walking down the halls of the school in high school, and I would see sometimes one of these guys, and he would have a girl with him, and he would have his arm around the girl, and she would have her head laying on his shoulder looking up at him with those great eyes that you girls have. And I wanted to do some of that too, but I found out little short fat boys that wear glasses didn't do any better with the girls than they did anywhere else. And I remember at age 14, we went to a dance. It was a high school dance held in an old dairy barn out in the country. The upstairs part of the dairy barn where they used to store the hay had been made into the dance floor. The downstairs portion where they had the stanchions and they milked the cows, they had put in tables and benches, and there you could sit and drink a Coke and talk and visit. And I remember going to that high school dance that night and went upstairs where all the kids were, and the music was playing and they were all out there dancing. And I looked out there and I spotted a little girl named Betty. And I'd been wanting to do something with Betty for a long time, but I was always afraid to ask her, because I knew that if I did, she would say no, and people would hear, and they would laugh, and I would be embarrassed. But I remember that night standing against the wall and watching Betty dance with a guy, and I said to myself, as soon as this music stops, I'm going to go over there and ask Betty to dance with me. And the music stopped, and I began to walk toward Betty, and as I did, my mind began to say such things as, what are you going to do if she says no? And all these kids are going to hear, and they're going to laugh, and you're going to be embarrassed. And my footsteps got a little slower, and before I could get to Betty, my mind said, well, what are you going to do? She says, yes. And you're going to step on her toes and stumble and fall and generally make a fool of yourself. And my footsteps slowed down a little more. And before I could get to Betty, the music started playing, and another guy grabbed her, and they started dancing. I went back over against the wall, and I said to myself, as soon as this music stops, I'm going to ask Betty to dance with me. Now, a tall, slender guy that I knew came sidling up to me, and he said, Charlie, he said, how would you like to go outside with me and have a drink of moonshine? Well, I didn't know what moonshine was, but I was afraid to tell him no, because the other kids had heard him ask me, and I knew they would laugh and I would be embarrassed if I said no. So I said, yeah, I guess so, that would be all right. And we went downstairs and we went to his car, and he opened up the trunk and he reached in and he got out a quart jar of moonshine. And he took the top off of the quart jar of moonshine, and as he did, the blue smoke began to curl up out of it. And he took a drink of it and he handed it to me, and I proceeded to take a drink of it. And as that moonshine crossed my lips immediately began to tingle. And as it struck my teeth began to kind of vibrate up and down. And when it hit my tongue, I could feel my tongue begin to grow and expand and swell. And it hit my cheeks, and they started fluttering in and out. And at the same time, I could feel it passing through my sinus cavities into my forehead. And I began to get a feeling in my forehead which was absolutely indescribably wonderful. I haven't swallowed the damn stuff yet. I've just got it in my mouth. When I swallowed that drink of moonshine, as it went down through my esophagus, you know what happened. I almost choked to death to start with. I could hardly get my breath. But as I was choking and gagging, I felt something begin to take place in my body. My chest began to grow and expand and swell and get bigger and bigger. And it hit my stomach, and it just literally exploded like a bomb. And I could feel it immediately racing through my arms, and they got longer and longer, and it hit my hands and fingers, and they began to tingle and vibrate. And at the same time, it's racing through my arms, it's racing through my legs, and they're getting longer and longer, and I'm getting taller and taller, and it hit my feet and toes, and I got a hot, intense, burning, exciting, get up and go somewhere and do something feeling. And he turned and he looked at me and he said, would you like to have another drink? And from the tremendous height that I'd already grown to, I looked down on his head and I said, yeah, I believe I'll have one more of those. And I took a second drink, and we put the lid on it and we put it back in the trunk of the car, and we began to go upstairs where the kids were dancing. And as I walked up those stairs, I began to experience a feeling I'd never felt before. You know, I began to comprehend the word serenity, and I knew peace. And no matter how far down the scale I had gone, I could see where my experience would benefit others. And that feeling of uselessness and self-pity began to disappear. and fear of people and economic insecurity began to leave me, and I intuitively knew how to handle situations which used to baffle me. And I suddenly realized that alcohol was doing for me what I could not do for myself. And I walked upstairs and I stood against the wall and the kids were dancing, and I said, as soon as the music stops, I'm going to go over there and ask Betty to dance with me. And the music stopped, and when it did, I began to walk toward Betty. And this time my mind didn't say, what are you going to do if she says no? Because I knew beyond any shadow of a doubt that Betty would say yes. And my mind didn't say, well, what are you going to do if she says yes and you stumble and fall? Because I knew I'd be able to dance with her and everything would be okay. And I marched straight up to Betty and I said, Betty, how would you like to dance with me? And she looked at me kind of funny and she said, well, yeah, Charlie, that would be fine. Sure, that's okay. And the music started and Betty and I began to dance. And sure enough, I didn't stumble and fall. And sure enough, I didn't step on her toes and make a fool of myself. And as the music ended, I found myself saying to Betty, Betty, would you like to dance with me again? And she looked at me kind of funny, and she said, well, yeah, Charlie, that's okay. She said, you're a pretty good dancer. She said, I didn't know you could dance. And I said, I didn't either, but let's do it one more time. Now, to best of my knowledge, Betty didn't dance with anybody else that evening. I really believe that she and I danced every dance together the rest of the evening, and as the evening began to draw to a close, I found myself doing something I'd never been able to do. I said, Betty, could I take you home from the dance? And she said, well, yeah, Charlie, yeah, that'd be all right. Now, I didn't have a car to take Betty home in, but I knew a guy that had one, and he was a tall, slender guy, and he had a quart of moonshine in the trunk of his car. And I asked him if Betty and I could go home with he and his girlfriend. I said, she's agreed to let me take her home from the dance, and I don't have any way to take her. And he said, well, sure, come on. He said, that'll be fine. We go downstairs, and we open up the trunk, and we get out the quart of moonshine, and Betty and I get in the back seat, and he and his girlfriend get in the front seat, and we begin to tool it down the road to take the girls home. Now, as we were driving down the road, my mind began to think. I said, I've asked this girl to dance with me, and she said, okay, and I've danced with her, and I didn't make a fool of myself, and she's letting me take her home from the dance. I wonder what she would do if I would put my arm around her and pull her over against my shoulder. Would she do as those girls do in school? We rode along a little more, and I thought about it some more, and I reached over, and I put my arm around Betty and pulled her over against my shoulder, and sure enough, she laid her head on my shoulder and looked at me with those great eyes that you girls have, and I thought, man, this is really living it up tonight. You know, this is great. And as we rode a little further, my mind began to think again. It said, you know, you've asked this girl to dance with you, and you've got her in the back seat of the car, and you're taking her home for the dance, and you got her head on your shoulder. And I thought, I wonder what she would do if I would kiss her. Now, I had never kissed a girl before, and I really didn't know how you were supposed to go about it, but I had seen them do it in the movies. And I knew that if you were going to kiss a girl, you needed to get her face just right. So I leaned over to Betty with her head on my shoulder, and I took my right hand, and I got her by the chin, and I got her face positioned just where I thought it ought to be. And I knew also you needed to close your eyes, so I closed my eyes and I leaned down and I put my lips against Betty's. Now, I don't really know what I expected to happen. I didn't know whether she would scream, slap my face or what, but you know, she acted like she enjoyed it. And in just a little bit, I felt her little lips begin to move and my little lips begin to move, and there began to flow electricity between the two of us. And I thought, my God, you really have been missing out on life. This is one of the greatest things you can have. And as we drove a little further, I began to think again. I thought, I've got this, asked this girl to dance with me, and I've taken her home from the dance, and we're in the back seat of this car, and her head's on my shoulder, and I've kissed her, and I thought, I wonder what she would do if I would reach over and get hold of one of those things. Now, I didn't know any more about getting hold of one of those things than I did about kissing. But I assumed if you're going to get hold of one of them, you need to be kissing them at the same time. So again, I reached over and I got Betty's face just right, and I leaned down to put my lips on hers. Only this time I didn't close my eyes because I wanted to see what my right hand was getting ready to do. And as I kissed Betty, my right hand reached down and got a hold of one of those things. Now, let me tell you something. If you're a little short, fat boy that's 14 years old and you've been wearing glasses all your life, and you kissing one of those girls and you get one of those things in your hand for the first time, that really is a feeling that is indescribably wonderful. I had never felt anything like that before, and I'm not so damn sure I've ever felt anything like that since. That was my first spiritual experience that night in the back seat of that car. Now, we're not going to talk any more about Betty. That's the end of that story. And people used to ask me, they'd say, "Charlie, why don't you finish that story?" And I used to say, well, the reason I don't finish that story is because I don't believe in talking about those things from behind the podium. But in the last few years, I've come to realize that the reason I don't finish that story is because I don't remember that story. Because something else transpired in my life that evening, too. As I was kissing Betty and getting hold of that thing and doing those things that was so important for this 14-year-old boy to do, that it seemed as though something within me from time to time would say, "Charlie, why don't you stop what you're doing here and reach over there and get some more of that stuff that's in that quart jar?" And I'd reach over there and I'd get another drink of that moonshine, put the lid on it, turn back to Betty. And after several drinks of that moonshine that evening, I simply went out of the picture, and I really don't remember what took place that night. I think I evidenced that night the first drink of hard alcohol I ever took, the first thing you got to have to be an alcoholic, and that's the physical allergy to alcohol. Because as that alcohol flowed into my system, it produced an actual physical craving within my body that it was absolutely became impossible for me to stop drinking. The big book says after we've had a drink or two, then alcohol becomes paramount to all other interests, and we simply cannot stop drinking after we have once started. And I believe the physical allergy was there that night when I took that first drink of moonshine. Now, the next morning, I woke up at home, and I didn't remember how I got there. I was sick, and I was shaking, and I was trembling, and I was hungover, and I felt like hell. And my mind began to go back to what transpired the night before. And as my mind went back to what transpired the night before, it dwelled on one thing and one thing only. That great, exciting, in-control feeling that I had when I took that first drink of moonshine. It didn't think about the fact that I drank so long I blacked out and couldn't remember what happened. It didn't think about the fact that I was sick and hung over and didn't feel good. It didn't think about the fact that I didn't know how I got home. It simply dwelt upon that great, exciting, in-control feeling that I took with that first drink. Dr. Silkworth tells us in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, he talks about that great feeling, that great sense of ease and comfort, and that exciting, in-control feeling that allowed me to do the night before what I could not do by myself. Other people, from the very beginning, could see the truth about my drinking. I was never able to see it. My mother said to me, she said, "Son, I need to talk to you about your drinking." She said, "Don't you know that you have an uncle in a state insane asylum in the state of California?" And she said, "He's a wet brain, and the reason he's a wet brain, he drank so much alcohol that he just literally destroyed his brain." And she said, "I saw him start drinking," and she said, "What I need to tell you is that you're drinking at age 14, 15, just exactly like he drank." And she said, "If you continue to drink the way you are, the day will come when you'll probably be in a state insane asylum also." My mother could differentiate the true from the false about my drinking, but I couldn't do that. I said, "Oh, Mother, you don't understand. I'm not like my uncle. If alcohol ever gets to be a serious problem in my life, then I'll stop drinking. You'll never have to worry about that." The complete inability to see the truth. Always when we think about alcohol, when we're sober, before AA, we think only about that great sense of ease and comfort. We don't think about the hospitals and the jailhouses and the divorce courts and the car wrecks, and we become people who have a form of insanity when it comes to alcohol. If you can see the truth about something, you're sane. If you can't see the truth, you're insane. And I was insane about alcohol from the very beginning. My dad said to me one day, he said, "Son, I need to talk to you about your drinking." He said, "Nobody in the Parmley family has ever been able to safely drink alcohol." And he said, "Every one of us that's ever tried it, we've ended up in serious, serious trouble. And those who haven't found a way to quit drinking are either locked up or they're dead." And he said, "You're no different from the rest of us." And I said, "Dad, you don't understand. I'm only half Parmley, so I'll not be like you other Parmleys. And if alcohol ever gets to be a problem in my life, I'll stop drinking. You'll not need to worry about that." When I was 17 years old, I woke up in an army hospital in Bremerhaven, Germany. And there was a doctor standing by the side of my bed, and he said, "Son, I need to talk to you about your drinking." He said, "I don't know whether you know it or not, but," he said, "you've already died twice in the last 2 days." And he said, "What I need to tell you is, if you continue to drink the way you drink, you'll never live to be age 30. I said, "Doctor, you don't understand me. That if alcohol ever gets to be a serious problem in my life, I'll stop drinking." The complete inability to see the truth about alcohol. We must have that if we're going to be a practicing alcoholic. Because when you and I are out there drinking, if we could see the jailhouses, if we could see the divorce courts and the hospitals and the jailhouses, we never would take the first drink. But just before we take the first drink, we simply cannot see those things. We can't differentiate that true from the false. When I was 21 years old, my wife said to me, she said, "Charlie, I need to talk to you about your drinking." She said, "I love you," and she said, "You're a fine, fine husband." And she said, "I would like to live the rest of my life with you, but what I need to tell you is that if you continue to drink the way you're drinking, sooner or later I'm going to have to leave you. I can't stay in a marriage that's going like this one is going, and it's caused by your drinking." And I said, "Sweetheart, you don't understand. If alcohol ever gets to be a serious problem for me and for our marriage, I'll stop drinking. You'll not have to worry about that." The complete inability to differentiate the truth from the false. When I was 28 years old, my boss called me in one day and he said, "Charlie, I need to talk to you about your drinking." He said, "You're one of the finest employees we've got." And he said, "I don't know whether you know it or not, but," he said, "you're slated to take my job when I retire in 2 years. But," he said, "what I need to tell you is you're drinking too much. And you're coming in the morning and you're hungover and your work's beginning to suffer." And he said, "I'm beginning to smell it on you once in a while." And he said, "What I need to tell you is if you continue to drink the way you are, you'll not have my job. In fact, we'll have to fire you." And I said, "Boss, you don't understand me. If my drinking interferes with my job, I'll quit drinking. Don't you worry about that." The complete inability to differentiate the truth from the false. 24 years after I took my first drink, I came to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. My mother and father were right. I had literally, practically destroyed my life in 24 years of drinking. My first wife was right. She had left me because of the drinking and broke up the marriage, and I hadn't seen her in many, many years. My boss was right. I had lost that great job that I loved so deeply, and all the jobs that I had after that up until the time I came to AA. The only one of the whole bunch that was not right was the doctor, because I hadn't died by age 30. I was 38 years old when I got to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, why did I come to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous? I'm really, really not sure. I think probably I came to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous because my second wife, a lady named Barbara, some of you know Barbara. If there's ever such thing as a black belt Al-Anon, Barbara is her. She's been in Al-Anon for 26 years, got a fine, fine program. Barbara had started the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. The Fellowship of Al-Anon. And she's going to Al-Anon and I'm drinking. Now, when she went to Al-Anon, strange things began to happen in our home. The first thing that began to happen is Barbara quit fighting with me. Always before, when I had needed an excuse to get drunk, and by that time I had to have an excuse to get drunk, I could pick a fight with Barbara, and then I could say, "Anybody that has to live with a woman like that deserves a drink." And then I could go on out and get drunk and feel fully justified in it. After she started Al-Anon, she wouldn't argue with me. And I remember one day I was trying to pick a fight with her to justify the drunk, and she turned on me and she pointed her hand at me and she said, "Charlie, I'm going to tell you something." She said, "I don't need you anymore." And I said, "You don't need me anymore. What are you talking about?" She says, "I found something better than you." And I said, "Who in the hell is he?" And she said, "It's God as I understand him." And I found him through the fellowship of Al-Anon. No, I didn't believe that at all. Some 30 days later, she said to me, she said, "Charlie, would you be willing to talk to somebody from Alcoholics Anonymous?" She said, "My sponsor, Wanda, her husband is named Floyd, and he would just be tickled to death to come by and talk to you about AA if you'd agree to talk about AA. And I said, "Okay, I guess I'll do that." Now, I didn't want to talk to Floyd to find out anything about AA. I wanted to find out what the hell Barbara was doing and who she had found at Al-Anon's what I wanted. And Floyd came to my home, and Barbara and Wanda left, and we sat down in my kitchen, and I shall never forget it. Floyd began to talk to me about his drinking. Now, everybody that ever talked to me about drinking before talked to me about my drinking. My wife did, and my brother did, and my mother did, and my father did, and the sheriff did, and the banker did. But Floyd didn't want to talk about my drinking. He sat there and talked to me about his drinking. And he began to tell me what happened whenever he took a drink. And he began to talk about the fact that he only was going to have one or two, but after it went into his system, he would be unable to stop drinking. And as I was able to say to myself, "Hell, that's exactly what's been happening to me for the last 24 years. And Floyd began to talk to me about this thing called the obsession of the mind. He said, "Charlie, I tried to quit drinking for years." And he said, "Every time I would try to quit for some strange reason, a day, a week, or a month later, I would find myself drunk all over again, not even knowing what caused me to take the first drink." And I said, "Floyd, that's what's been happening to me for the last 4 or 5 years, because I had really been trying to stop drinking on my own." And Floyd, through sharing his story with me, helped me see what my problem is, the physical allergy, the obsession of the mind. And when he got through, he said, "Charlie, would you like to go to an AA meeting?" And I said, "Yeah, I guess I'll go. And I'll see what's going on down there. And then maybe I'll see who Barbara has really found whenever I get there." Now, God works in very funny, mysterious ways. That's been now about 26 years ago. And my friend Floyd has never been able to get any sobriety. He stays sober for 30 days or 90 days or 6 months, and he gets drunk and he gets sick and he gets in trouble. And he calls me, and I go to his home, and I kind of help him out and pick him up and clean him up and get him back into AA. Today he's an absolute wet brain, and he's a hopeless cripple. God most certainly does work in mysterious ways. That's why I'm always so willing to say that it's only by the grace of God that I'm here and Floyd's not here. A gift unwarranted, certainly not because of anything that I've ever done. I went to the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in a little town called Siloam Springs, Arkansas. Now, in Siloam Springs, Arkansas, there was an AA group that had been meeting there for years, and it was called the Borderline Group. And I thought, man, they have made this group just especially for people like me. I'm not an alcoholic, but I might be a borderline case. So this group is for people just exactly like I am. Today I realize they called it the Borderline Group because it's situated on the border of Oklahoma and Arkansas. But I thought it was for people just like me, special borderline cases. I walked in the door of the meeting on Friday night, and I was absolutely amazed. You know what I expected to see. A bunch of old, beat-up, broken-down, crippled people. Old men, long hair, all of them needing shave, and none of them getting around very good. I expected to see a bunch of women who were not very clean, and their hair wouldn't be fixed up, and they would be very straggly-looking individuals. And as I opened the door of the meeting, I walked in, and probably there was about 20 people there that night. And they did something that night that impressed me then, and it's never failed to impress me since. Everybody in the room walked up to me and said, "Hello, Charlie. How are you? stuck their hand out, shook my hand, and said, "Come in. Have you been having a little trouble with alcohol?" And I said, "Yes, I have, and I guess the reason I'm here is to find out what to do about it." And they proceeded to tell me. One person said, "Well, we find for new people that you need to go to 4, 5, 6, 7 AA meetings a week. The more you go, the more you're around people who, like you, are staying or trying to stay sober, the better chance you have of sobriety." Another one reached over and he picked up a book, a big old blue book, and he handed it to me and he said, "Charlie, this is the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous." And he said, "In this book is the story of how the first 100 people in AA recovered from alcoholism." And he said, "If you'll read it and study it and do what it says, you'll never have to drink again if you don't want to drink." And another older fella sitting there, and you see him at every AA meeting, bald-headed, sitting back in the back of the room. And he kind of smiled at me, and he said, "Son, if you really want to stay sober someday, you have to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand Him." And I said to these lovely people, "You people don't understand me. You know, I said, I love you, and you've made me feel welcome, and your coffee tastes pretty good, but you really don't understand me. I said, you see, I've got a farm up here, and I raise 45,000 chickens on that farm. And I've got a 100-head cattle operation. And I've got a 500-hog feeder operation over here. And I've got a red-headed wife, 4 kids, and 2 bird dogs. And if you're going to take care of all that kind of mess, you've got to stay home and get your rest. There's no way I can come to 4, 5, or 6, or 7 AA meetings a week." I took your book and I opened it up to where they told me to, chapter 5, how it works. And I read step 1 and it said, "We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Our lives had become unmanageable." And I said, "I'm not powerless over anything. And I never have been and never will be." And step 2 said, "Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity." I said, "Man, don't tell me I'm crazy. Oh yeah, I do some stupid things when I'm drinking. But when I'm sober, I'm much like everybody else." Now, if you're not powerless and you're not nuts, then there's no way you could turn your will and your life over to the care of something you don't understand in the first place. And I said, "Don't tell me about God. I already know about God. Because you see, I was born in a good old Southern Baptist church. Now, I don't know if you got Baptists up here, but I don't know if they're like the Southern Baptist we got down there. And when I'd go to those Southern Baptist church meetings, I'd hear about God, and surely they talked about a kind and a loving God, but if they did, it never got to the pew I sat in. I heard only about hellfire and brimstone and going to hell for lying and cheating and stealing and drinking whiskey and committing adultery. And by the time I got to AA, I'd been doing that for 24 years. And I knew that God had already told St. Peter, when that little four-eyed sucker gets up here, send him downstairs. We'll not need his kind." I said, "I can't do these things you're telling me to do. But I said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to come to your meetings here in Siloam Springs every Friday night, and I'm not going to miss a meeting. And I'm going to work this program any way I want to, and by golly, I'm going to stay sober. And if you don't believe me, you watch me. I'm getting ready to do it." Thank God for the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Any other fellowship in the world? Any other fellowship in the world would have taken an arrogant little old SOB like me and picked him up by the seat of the britches and thrown him right out the door. And all they did was rear back and smile and said, "Keep coming back." And I went to their meetings every Friday night, and I didn't miss a meeting on Friday night. And as time went by, I began to get sicker and sicker and sicker and sicker. Yeah, I began to worry more and more about what Barbara is doing with whoever it is that she found. I began to worry more about the banker calling in the notes that are overdue. I began to worry more about what the neighbors are thinking about. Barbara filed for divorce 3 times, and I've allowed to let her move back in my home. You know how those things go with us. I began to become very upset with my children and my neighbors and everybody around me. The book talks about being restless, irritable, and discontented. I was also filled with shame, fear, guilt, remorse, and anger, and I didn't feel good. And I wanted to feel better. And I only knew one thing that would make me feel better. And I'd been heard of talking about having a slip, and I decided it's time for me to have one of those things. And after 90 days, I took a drink of whiskey in order to feel better. And sure enough, it worked like magic. for just about 10 minutes. And then almost immediately I had to have another drink and another drink and another drink. And in those days, when I would once start drinking, I would be unable to stop drinking. I would just have to drink until I was so sick that I just couldn't drink anymore. And after 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 weeks, I don't know how long, I went to the liquor store and I got my daily ration of vodka and I got some beer to go with it. And slowly, slowly, I would lay the vodka down, switch over to the beer, and after another week or two of drinking beer, then I could slowly, slowly taper off of the beer, and I ended up stopping drinking after 2 or 3 weeks of trying to stop drinking. I finally got it shut off, and I did the only thing that I've ever done right in my life. I went right back to the meeting at Siloam Springs, and I walked into the AA meeting on Friday night, and there they all stood, and they had their hands sticking out, and they said, "Hello, Charlie, how are you?" They said, "Man, we're glad to see you back. Have you been having a little trouble with alcohol?" And I said, "Yes, I have, and I guess the reason I'm here is to find out what to do about it." And they proceeded to tell me. One guy said, "You need to go to 4, 5, 6, 7 AA meetings a week." And one of them said, "Take the book and read it and study it and do what it says and you'll be okay." And the same old bald-headed poot, he looked at me and he said, "Son, sooner or later, if you want to stay sober, you'll find it necessary to turn your will and your life over to the care of God. You understand him?" And I said, "You people don't understand me. I can't do those things. I absolutely cannot do them." But I said, "I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll come to your meetings here on every Friday night, and I'll work this program the way I want to, and I'm going to stay sober. And if you don't believe me, you watch me. I'm getting ready to do it." And they all reared back and smiled and said, "Keep coming back." Thank God for the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to their meetings every Friday night, and as time went by, again, I found myself getting sicker and sicker and sicker and sicker, and I vowed that I would stay sober at least 90 days, and sure enough, 90 days passed, and then 100 days passed, and then 110 days passed, but I wasn't getting any better, because you see, I had done nothing to change the way I think. All I had done was take the greatest thing that I ever found in my life, that thing that had always made me feel good, that thing that had always allowed me to do the things I couldn't do for myself. That thing was the only friend that I ever had. I had taken it out of my life, and I had replaced it with nothing else. And as time went by, I got sicker and sicker and sicker. And at the end of 6 months, I said to myself, if this is the way you feel when you're sober, if this is the only way you can live, then to hell with it. I don't care whether I live or not. And I reached over and I took a drink of alcohol. And sure enough, it triggered the allergy, and I couldn't stop drinking. And after 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 weeks, I don't know how long, doesn't make any difference, I got myself all the way down. I drank till I couldn't drink anymore. And I went to the liquor store and I got my vodka and I got my beer and I gradually tapered off the vodka and got on to the beer. Gradually tapered off the beer and got sober. And I did the only thing that I've ever done right. I went right back to the meeting in Siloam Springs, Arkansas on Friday night. I opened the door and walked in, and there they all stood, and they had their hands sticking out, and they said, "Hello, Charlie." They said, "How are you?" They said, "Man, we're glad to see you back. Have you been having a little trouble with alcohol?" And I said, "Yes, I have. And I guess I'm here to find out what to do about it." And they proceeded to tell me. One of them said, "By God, you need to go to 4, 5, 6, 7 AA meetings a week." The other one took this book, and he said, "Take this damn book and do what it says, and you'll be all right." To God, I want to say to so many of them today, just take this damn book, and you'll be all right. Yeah. The old bald-headed poot, he looked at me, and he said, "Boy," he said, "I'm getting pretty damn tired of telling you this. But if you want to stay sober, sooner or later, you're going to have to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand him." And I said, "You people don't understand me. I simply cannot do those things that you're telling me to do." And as I look back at that time in my life, now I know why I could not do those things. It wasn't because I didn't want to. It wasn't because I'm not capable of it. It was because I had never been defeated in my life. You see, I could stop drinking. Oh, yeah, it was hard to stop. Oh, yeah, it would take me 3 or 4 weeks to get tapered off and quit and be sick as hell, but I could stop drinking on my own. Now, if you could stop drinking on your own, then there's no way that you're alcohol. And if you're not powerless over alcohol, then you don't care to do all these things that they were telling me to do. I said, I can't do these things, but I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to come to your meetings on Friday night, and I'm going to work this program any way I want to. And I'm going to stay sober, and if you don't believe me, you watch me. I'm getting ready to do it. And they just reared back and smiled and said, keep coming back. 9 months later, I reached a point where I'd never been before. 9 months later, I said to myself, if I have to live this way, and if I can't drink any more whiskey, and if I can't find a way to feel better, then I just might as well kill myself. Now, I never really cared too much about killing myself. Didn't then and don't now. But life had become so unbearable. I was really faced with one of three decisions. Number one, kill yourself. Number two, do what they're telling you to do in AA. Number three, take a drink and get drunk. And it looked to me like taking a drink and getting drunk would be the easiest way out. Damn sight easier than killing myself, and sure easier than doing what they told me to do. And I took a drink and I got drunk. Only this time I knew what would happen to me. There was no question in my mind. By now I could differentiate the true from the false. And I knew that if I got drunk, I'd get sick and I'd get in all kinds of trouble. But I was willing to pay the price to escape the pain of trying to live sober with nothing to replace alcohol. And I took a drink and I triggered the allergy and I got drunk. And 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 weeks later, I drank myself all the way down. Got so sick I couldn't drink anymore. And I went to the liquor store and I got my vodka and I got my beer. And I began to taper off of that vodka, only I found out this time I didn't taper. I'd drink the beer and it would be just like drinking water. And I would have to drink some more vodka. And after a while I reached the point that I would wake up in the morning and I would be sick and shaking and trembling and sweating all over, swearing that I wasn't going to take a drink that day, but being so sick I had to have a drink, and I'd take a drink of vodka and I'd pass out, and I'd wake up in an hour or two or three swearing I wouldn't drink anymore but have to have a drink and pass out. And the days began to stretch into weeks, and the weeks began to stretch into a month or two, and I began to get to the point where I couldn't eat and I couldn't sleep and I couldn't drink coffee and I couldn't smoke cigarettes. All I could do is drink that vodka and pass out, and drink vodka and pass out. And Barbara and the kids moved me on an old cot out in the utility room. And I remember one day Barbara opened the door at the utility room and stuck her head in, and she looked at me and she said, "Hun, you're sick, aren't you?" And I said, "God, yes, I'm sick." And she said, "Do you have anything to drink?" And I said, "No, I don't." And she said, "I'll be right back." And she left, and about an hour she returned, and she had a brown paper bag, and it had 12 pints of vodka in it, all different flavors of vodka. And she said, "Here, you love this more than anything in the world. Take this from me." Now, for years, I thought she did that out of the goodness of her heart. But I learned that in Al-Anon, she learned, let the little sucker drink all he wants to drink. The more he drinks, the faster he drinks, the sooner he'll hit bottom. And he'll either hit bottom and sober up, or he'll die from alcoholism, and in her case, she wouldn't have to worry about it anymore. So Barbara was really helping me get to bottom, is what she was doing. And I drank those 12 pints of vodka, and I woke up one morning, and I knew that I was dying from alcoholism. Now, I didn't want to die, and I sure as hell didn't want to die drunk. And I did something I'd never been able to do before in my life, and by this time, almost 39 years of drinking. And I said, "Barbara, I've got to have some help. I can't stop drinking." And that's all she was waiting on. She got to the phone. She called Floyd. And Floyd and a fellow named Buss came over to the house. And Buss was a great, big, tall, strong, rough, gruff telephone line repairman. Big, big man, probably 6'6". And they walked in to the door of the utility room. And they looked at me, and Buss said to Floyd, "My God, we got to get him in a hospital." He said, "If we try to sober him up, he's going to die on us." And that's what we used to do, is sober each other up in our homes. In those days, you could hardly get in the hospital. Certainly, you couldn't get in for alcoholism. It had to be for gastroenteritis or some other fancy disease. It couldn't be alcoholism. And Floyd said, come on, Charlie, let's go to the hospital, and I'll talk to the doctor, and we'll get you in there, and we'll get you some help. And I looked straight at those two guys, and I said, boys, I don't really believe I'm that bad. I believe I can handle this my way. And Buss turned to Floyd, and he said, Floyd, let's go home. He said, and there's nothing we can do for him. Until he's ready to stop, until he's ready for help, we can't help him at all. Thank God for the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. They left, and as they left, Floyd stuck his head back in the door of the utility room, and he had tears in his eyes. And he said, Charlie, when you need me, call me, and I'll be back. And they left. And I don't know how long it took, an hour, two, three, four, doesn't make any difference. I knew I couldn't stop drinking. I knew that this time I really had to have some help. And somehow I got to the phone this time. And I called Floyd, and he came to my house. And when he drove up in my yard, I was sitting on a front porch with a half a can of beer in my hand. And he got out of his pickup truck, and he said, come on, boy, let's go to the hospital and get you some help. Bring your beer and you can drink it on the way to the hospital. I said, Floyd, I don't want this beer. I have had all I can stand. I don't want any more. And I set the beer down on the porch and we left. And it's the first time in 24 years of drinking that I can ever remember that I walked away from anything that had alcohol in it. Always I had to finish it up before I could leave it. This time I left a half can of beer. We went to the hospital. And they put me in a hospital, and there they gave me the proper medication to ward off the convulsions, the DTs, and etc. And I don't know what happened. I woke up in there two or three days later. I had vague memories of a lot of screaming and shouting and carrying on. I had bruises on my arms and on my legs where I had been tied down, and I just got vague memories of that. But I woke up at that hospital at a place that I'd never been before. Not in my body, but in my mind. I woke up at a place of absolute, complete defeat. For the first time, I had had to surrender. I have no problem in identifying with Bill Wilson in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, when he says, no words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me. I met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. And I knew that if I left that hospital, I was going to drink. And I knew that if I drank again, I would surely die. And I really didn't know what to do about it. Absolutely blows my mind today to realize that I was in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous for a year and a half. And when I reached bottom, I didn't know what to do about it. But I remembered one old-timer had said to me that if you ever, in complete desperation, don't know which way to turn, he said, try a little prayer and see what happens. And I remember laying there looking straight up at the ceiling and saying, do I dare pray? And my mind said, no, you don't pray. Only weak people pray. Strong people like you stand on their own two feet. They don't ask help from anything or anybody. My mind said, well, what are you going to do if you don't pray? And my mind said it wouldn't do any good to pray because God's not going to do anything for you because of what you've been in the past. And my mind said, yeah, but what are you going to do if you don't pray? And after a while, my mind said, Charlie, what would it hurt to try? There's not a soul in this room but you. And if you prayed and it didn't work, nobody would see it and nobody would know it except you. And I looked straight at that ceiling and I uttered a prayer, which about as false as anything I ever uttered. I said, God, if there is a kind and a loving God, can you remove from me the obsession to drink? And I really don't know what happened. I wasn't like Bill. I didn't feel as if the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. I didn't see any lights flash. I didn't hear any bell ring. But the instant I uttered the prayer, I knew I never had to drink again if I didn't want to drink anymore. That's the grace of God. Here was an old mind filled with withdrawal drugs. Here was an old mind that had been drunk literally for months. And for just a moment, I had a moment of clarity. And I could see what alcohol was doing to me with a desire to do something about it. And I turned to God I did not understand and asked for the help. And the obsession to drink was lifted from me at that moment. It has never returned since that date. Thank God for that. I left that hospital not knowing how I was going to stay sober, not knowing what I needed to do, but I knew the answer was within the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the only place that I'd ever felt comfortable, the only place I'd ever even begin to feel at home outside of a bar. And I knew I needed to go back to AA. And on that Friday night, I did the only thing I've ever done right. I went right back to the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there they all stood, and they had their hands sticking out, and they said, "Hello, Charlie, how are you?" They said, "Man, we're glad to see you. You've been having no trouble with alcohol." I said, "Yes, I have." Now, I didn't ask them what to do about it, and they didn't tell me what to do about it. I started going to 4, 5, 6, 7 AA meetings a week. I began to read and study the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I began to ask this God that I did not understand each morning to please give me one more day of sobriety. And I began to thank that God each night for that day of sobriety. And this time, as the days went by, I didn't get sicker and sicker and sicker. This time, as the days went by, I began to lose some of that old restlessness, that old irritability, that old discontent. As the days went by, I began to lose some of that anger, guilt, shame, and remorse that I had lived with all my life. And today, as I look back at that time now, I begin to realize what had happened to me. Because you see, this time I went to the big book in a different place. This time I went to the front of the big book. This time I began to read and study the doctor's opinion. This time, as I read and studied the doctor's opinion, I really began to understand what Floyd had said to me when he came to my kitchen and talked to me. I begin to understand what the physical allergy really is. And I begin to understand because of that physical allergy that I would never be able to safely drink again. As I read and studied the doctor's opinion, and I begin to see this statement that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol, that they want that great sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. And the idea of taking the few drinks and a sense of ease and comfort was so strong that it would make us believe that it's okay to drink. I began to understand the insanity of alcoholism. I began to understand the obsession of the mind. I began to see why I could no longer stay sober, left on my own resources. And for the first time, I could understand that if you can't safely drink, and if you can't stay sober, then most certainly you're powerless over alcohol. That came to me through the doctor's opinion in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I could see that if I'm powerless over alcohol, then apparently I'm going to have a power greater than I am if I'm going to recover from that condition. Because I had already tried to recover from that condition on my own. I had already tried to recover from that condition through the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I began to see that no human power could help me recover from that condition. If my problem is powerless, then the answer must lie in power. And it has to be a power greater than human power. And for the first time, I could begin to believe that there just might be a power greater than I am that could restore me to sanity. I didn't know that there was, but I began to believe that there was. I began to experience the first two things I think we need to know for recovery. I began to experience the powerless condition and the need for the power. Now, if my problem is powerless, and if the answer is power, then I need to know one more thing. And when I got to chapter 5, it told me exactly how to find that power. You see, I'd tried to start recovery in chapter 5 in the first place. Chapter 5 starts with step 3. I didn't know anything about 1 and 2. That information came to me from the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters. And I saw that the first thing I needed to do if I'm going to recover from that condition and find that power is to make a decision about that power. Is that power going to run my life, or am I going to run my life? Now, the mess that I had made with my life made it much easier for me to make a decision to let God be the director of my will and of my life, because I had literally destroyed me and everybody around me. And I made that decision, and I uttered the prayer in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous in step 3. You know, it seemed to me as though the first time I did step 3, I did get on my knees. And I said, God, I offer myself to do with me and build with me as thou wilt. So on and so on and so forth. And it seemed as though I heard a deep voice that said, what an order, I can't go through with that. But I did my best in step 3. Now today I realize that step 3 is but a decision. You know, I hear people in AA today say, I've been in AA 5 years, my life's still all screwed up, I don't know why. Because I turned it over to God 2 years ago when I took step 3. I made the same mistake. I thought I turned it over in 3. Today I realize I just made a decision to turn it over. And what I really decided to turn over was my will, which is my thinking, and my life, which is my actions. And I really began to see that the way I had always thought is what caused me to do the things I did and literally destroyed me. And that if God could begin to direct my thinking, then maybe my actions would get better and my life would be better. I found out in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, step 3, although a vital and crucial step, would have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. And I began to look into this step 4 idea. And at first I thought it was a list of dirty, filthy, nasty items. But as I read and studied the book, I realized it wasn't. It asked me to take an honest look at my resentments. It asked me to take an honest look at my fears. It asked me to take an honest look of the guilt and the remorse and the things I felt from those people I had hurt. And as I went into step 4, I began to realize my resentments and fears were not true. That always I made decisions based on self, which hurt other people, and they would retaliate against me, and then I would resent, and I would play that over and over and over, and gradually change the picture, and make them the devil, and make me as pure as the driven snow, and transfer all blame to them. You know, if you're practicing alcoholic, you got to be able to develop those kind of skills. Damn hard to live with ourselves drinking if we had to see the truth. But we don't have to see the truth. We transfer blame to others through the resentments. And for the first time I saw in step 4 that I had become a very selfish, very dishonest, very self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate human being. And if I continued to operate on that type of character, that I would continue to do the same things I'd always done. Continue to hurt people, they would retaliate and create pain for me, and I'd end up drunk over it. And I took this step 4, and I took it to another human being, not only God, but another human being. And I needed that human being, because I needed somebody to look at my step 4 and show me the truth of it. I've been such a con artist all my life, it was impossible for me to see the truth about me when I took step 4. In step 5, he helped me see those things that I couldn't see. He helped me see how certain things was caused by my selfishness. Certain things were caused by my dishonesty. Certain things were caused by my inconsideration of other people. You know, I always thought I was an oversexed human being. I found out in step 5, hell, I'm not oversexed, I'm undersecure. And I use sex to build my self-esteem, to make me feel like somebody. And he helped me see those things I couldn't see about me. And there he and I looked at my character defects. In step 6, I became willing to turn loose of them. Not because I wanted to, but I knew that if I don't turn loose of them, I'm going to continue to live the same old way. And sooner or later, it'll cause me to drink. And I remember getting on my knees and asking God to take away my selfishness, my dishonesty, my self-seeking, frightened character, my inconsideration of other people. And I assumed that all I got to do is ask God, and he would give me the $29.95 special and zap me and make me as pure as the driven snow. But I found out that isn't true either. I found out if I want God to take away selfishness, then I've got to start practicing unselfishness. If I want him to take away dishonesty, I've got to start trying to be honest. If I want him to take away fear, then I got to start practicing courage. And if I want him to take away inconsideration, I must consider other people. Step 6 to me was, don't do what I always did before. Step 7 is do something entirely opposite with God's help, and slowly the old me began to die, and a new me began to take its place. I found out if I wanted the final peace of mind, serenity, and happiness I need for long-term sobriety, I must do something about the fear, the shame, the guilt, and the remorse associated with the people I've hurt in the past. And I took step 8 and 9. And through 8 and 9, I began to get rid of those things. And for the first time, I began to really feel better. In fact, my book promised me that before I was halfway through that phase of my development, which phase, step 8 or 9, that I would begin to feel these things, that I would know a new freedom and a new happiness, that I would comprehend the word serenity and I'd know peace. And one day I woke up to the fact, hey, the first 9 steps are given to me in my mind the same thing I used to get from a drink of whiskey. When a drink of whiskey was my friend at age 14, all the great feelings I got from the first drink came to me through the first 9 steps. And as I begin to receive those promises in my life, I begin to realize I'm an entirely different person than I was when I came in here. The old restlessness, irritability, discontent, shame, fear, guilt, and remorse had disappeared and been replaced with an entirely new set of ideas. I woke up to the fact one day at the end of step 9, through the receiving of the promises, I had a personality change sufficient to recover from alcoholism, and I damn near quit right then. I said to myself, my God, you can't possibly feel any better than this. But somebody said, Charlie, don't quit. They said, my God, if you quit now, you'll begin to slip back. They said, there's a spiritual axiom here that says nothing ever stays the same. And they said, you've made a tremendous amount of spiritual growth through the first 9 steps, but if you try to stop, you'll start to slip back, and you'll have trouble with people, then yourself, then with God, and the next thing you know, you're going to be sick and in trouble and drunk again. And I began to look into 10, 11, and 12. Now, they told me that 10, 11, and 12 were maintenance steps, and I looked at them for a while as a way to maintain my sobriety. But then I said to myself, if you can never stay the same, if everything's always changing, then you can't maintain. Surely 10, 11, and 12 must be to continue the spiritual growth I'd made through the first 9 steps. And I went back into Bill's story, and I saw where Bill talked about a fourth dimension of existence. I looked in chapter 2, and I saw where it talked about a fourth dimension of existence, far beyond the normal 3. I believe in the first 9 steps, in 1, 2, and 3, I got right in the spiritual dimension. I got right with God. 4, 5, 6, and 7, I got right in the mental dimension, I got right with me. 8 and 9, I got right in the physical, sociological dimension, I got right with my fellow man. Now then, if I could just get into another dimension of living. And I began to look at step 10 as a growth step. And I began to realize that somewhere, somehow, sometime, AA had made a serious mistake. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous appeared to the world in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. First time the world ever saw them in 1939. Somewhere we took the steps out of the book and we put them on charts and hung them on the wall. We took them out of the book and put them on little cards we carry in our wallets and purses. Now that's not the mistake. The mistake is when we took the steps out of the book and put them on the wall chart and the little cards, we left the instructions on how to work them in the book. And people go to AA today and they read the steps off the wall. And step 10 says we continue to take personal inventory when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. And every day I could say, well, I hadn't done anything wrong today, so I've done step 10. The book doesn't say that at all. The book says we continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. That's step 4. And said when these crop up, we ask God to remove them immediately. That's step 5 and 6. It said then we discuss them with someone immediately. That's step 5. And then it said we make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. And one day I realized, hey, this thing is telling me to continue to work 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 every day for the rest of my life. I defy anybody in this room to work 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 every day the rest of your life and stay the way you are. You can't do that. As I work 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, looking into my head every day, I learn more about me. When these things crop up in my mind, selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, I look into my mind and learn more about me. When I ask God to take them away, they become less and less. When I discuss them with another human being, I learn more. When I make amends quickly, my relationship with the world and everything in it gets better and better and better. And one day I begin to realize I have moved into a fourth dimension of existence. You can't describe it. You can't explain it. You can only feel it. And through the practice of step 10, gradually my relationship with God, myself, and the world and everybody in it got better and better and better. And then my book said, be careful, because here is the danger part, and this is the place where you can really get in trouble. My God, if you've got the promises in your life and you're feeling the way the book says you're going to feel, things are getting better. You know, you probably got back in the house by now. If you're real lucky, you might be in the bedroom by now. Yeah. Yeah, the kids are probably speaking to you again. The dogs quit biting you. You got a job, you got a car, and things start getting awful important to you. And you may try to stop right here. And you can't stop, because if you stop, you slip back. The book says we may become complacent. And it said we're headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We're not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition for that day. There's the word maintenance, one day at a time. That's it. One day at a time. My book talked to me. I'm going to be through in a few minutes. Don't worry. My book talked to me about a sixth sense of direction in step 11. And I realize that everything I know on a conscious level, I've learned through five senses of direction. I can see, I can smell, I can taste, I can hear, I can touch. Everything I know on a conscious level, I've learned through those five senses. But I take everything I know, and everything you know, and everything every human being in the world knows, and it's just a tiny, tiny speck of information compared to the knowledge of the universe. This book tells me that God has all knowledge and all power. And this book tells me that God dwells within each of us. Now, if that's true, then it stands to reason you and I have within ourselves all the knowledge and all the power we'll ever need to handle any conceivable situation that can come up in the future if we just learned how to tap into it. And my book called that a sixth sense of direction. And through prayer and meditation, we can learn to tap into that. And then's when we intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. When we can start tapping into that knowledge and that power, then life starts becoming pretty simple. It really does. Yeah. After the end of step 11, I experienced the greatest thing a human being can have. I experienced the greatest promise in the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. Having had a spiritual awakening is the result of these steps. What is a spiritual awakening? Bill tells us in the 12 and 12, the spiritual awakening, there's just as many of them as there are people in AA, but they've all got certain things in common. And that is that we're able to feel, believe, and do things we could never do before on our own strength unaided. Yeah, I feel things I never felt before. I feel love, patience, tolerance, compassion, goodwill. My God, before AA, I could have cared less about you. Oh yeah, you could have had some after I got all mine. I don't feel that way anymore. I believe things I never believed before. I believe God is a kind and a loving God. I believe He stands ready to help any human being anywhere in the world the instant they're ready to give up on self and turn back to Him. See, I thought before He was hellfire and brimstone. I thought He was a God of justice, not a God of mercy. Thank God He's not a God of justice. If He was a God of justice, I wouldn't be here today. And some of you probably wouldn't be here today either. Surely He's pure love. I can do things I could never do before. By golly, I can stay sober. I never could do that before. And because of the fact I'm stay sober, I can do many, many things I could never do before. So surely I've had some kind of spiritual awakening. Now what am I supposed to do with that? Well, my book tells me what I'm supposed to do with it. I'm supposed to carry this message. Not a message, not some message, not the message, this message to other alcoholics. What is this message? This message is the program of recovery contained in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Y'all take the new man today. I take the new man today that I'm going to sponsor, and the first thing we do is we get into the doctor's opinion in Bill's story. And we help him see through this book, not just my story, but through this book, what his problem is. We help him see his obsession of the mind and the physical allergy. Then we go into chapter 2, 3, and 4, and we help him come to believe there's a power greater than he is, can restore him to sanity. And then we go to chapter 5, and he makes his decision with me beside him, holding hands with each other. And I don't turn loose of his hand as we work our way through 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. That's our job as recovered alcoholics, to help others have a spiritual awakening also. That's the only thing we're here for. Now, I used to have trouble with God's will. I used to say, God, if you want me to live with this woman, give me a sign. Make the sun come up in the morning. Today I don't do that anymore. I know what God's will is. Especially standing here today in the spot we're in, my God, we must know what God's will is. Surely God got tired of seeing people us die back in the 1930s. Surely God took Bill and Bob and Ebby Thatcher and Roland Hazard and Dr. Jung and Dr. Silkworth and all the first 100 and put this thing together so you and I could have it in the pure form that it's in today. Surely that was God's business then. And God's always worked with people through people. Now the first 100's all dead. And if he picked people then surely he's picking them today. There's not an alcoholic in this room that ought to even be here today. Every one of us ought to be dead. Some of us 2, 3, 4 times. And we'd say, my, wasn't we lucky last night? Luck didn't have anything to do with it. God picked you out. And he lets you suffer your alcoholism so you can learn what he wants you to learn. And when he got ready to use you, then he removed the obsession to drink. There's no doubt in my mind about what God's will is for me, is to carry this message to other alcoholics. They tell me that 97 out of 100 alcoholics are going to die not even knowing they're alcoholic. 3% of us stumble into AA. Less than half of us are recovering. I used to say, God, why am I an alcoholic today? I say, God, why not me? God surely has a plan for you and I. And our message is so simple. So simple. You know, I think you and I are the luckiest people in the world. We, through our program, have been allowed the great privilege of living two lifetimes in one lifetime. A lifetime of what we used to be and a lifetime of what we are today. We are not what we used to be. God has fit us with some very unique knowledge to help a very unique group of individuals. We have the knowledge and the ability to avert death in countless thousands and thousands of people. If we're willing to do what this book tells us to do, very few people have that privilege. I really do believe we're the luckiest people alive today. Most of them out there are sick. They're going to the grave sick. They don't even know what's wrong with them. We not only know we're sick, we know what's wrong with us, and we have the tools to do something about it, and then we can use that to help somebody else. God's always said, put no other gods before me and do what you can for your fellow man. And if you and I put God first in our life and carry our message to other alcoholics, then surely we're going to receive everything we need. I have to do one more thing and then I'm through. I've got to practice these principles in all my affairs. That's the hardest job to do I've ever had to do in my life. What are the principles? I think it's very simple. Bill says, and how it works, do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. The principles we've set down are guides to progress. In the front of the 12 and 12, he says the 12 steps are a set of principles spiritual in nature. Every time I've ever seen him mention them in writing, it's been in connection with the steps. They are the principles. They are the guidelines. They are the tenets. They are the program. One place he even called them proposals. Hell, he calls them a bunch of different things. They are the principles. Now, it's easy for me to practice the 12 steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love you. You love me, I hope. And hopefully we're not going to hurt each other. But I'm only in AA 1 or 2 hours a day. What do I do the rest of the time? Do I practice these principles in my home with my spouse? Can I really, really admit how powerless I am over that lady? Can I realize the insanity in trying to control her, knowing I can't? Can I make a decision, turn her will and her life over to the care of God as I understand Him? Can I inventory me and find those defects that keep me trying to control her? Can I talk about that to another human being? Can I become willing to turn those defects loose and start working on them? Can I make amends to her quickly when I've harmed her? You know, there's times I'm ashamed of me. There's times I treat absolute strangers on the street with more courtesy than I do my own wife in my own home. God, just think, if I could practice these principles there with her and she with me, why, we could be happy and peaceful and serene 10, 12, 14 hours a day in our home. Can I do it with my kids? If I can do it with my kids, what time we have together is good times. If I can't, I'm trying to control their resistance. We have no times at all. Can I do it on the job? Can I do it with my co-workers? Can I practice the principles there? If I could, I might be happy on the job 8 hours a day. My old sponsor used to say to me, Charlie, you can be just as happy as you want to be. And I'd say, you old fart, you don't know what you're talking about. Today I hear myself say to people, you can be just as happy as you want to be. We have the tools. They're in this book. You know, you and I can be happy, peaceful, and free 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, if we really practice these principles in all our affairs. God's not going to do it for you. Other people won't do it for you. But you, with God's help and the help of others, can do it for yourself. Thank you all for letting me be here. I appreciate it.